welcome to another episode of Radio Warner. The date today is December 22nd, 2024. And this is episode 490. You're listening to Radio Warner. Subscribe at patreon.com/Radio Warner. I am the co-host, Mark Ames, coming to you from Western New York, where it's really cold. And it's a very white Christmas here, which is strange because it's been a very climate changey Christmas and winter every year, but this year seems to be different.
Yeah, that's what I remember from other Christmas Radio Warners.
Yeah.
You would be stuck snowless in Rochester.
As you can hear, I'm on the line, of course, with John Dolan, the Warner, aka Gary Brecher. Yeah, Frosty melted before we could even get him up. Actually, we did have a Frosty. There was a brief snow, and then the whole thing melted. And we thought, okay, that's it for winter. Yeah. It was like 3 days. But
you should have put a little polar bear on him, and it would have just melted.
Sometimes we seem to just get like a direct, because of where we are, just sort of the direct Arctic flow. It just pushes down every now and then. But, you know, this whole area, this was like real, it has the scars of the retreat of the Ice Age. The Finger Lakes, all that is just glacial retreat. And so it's kind of cool in that way. The Finger Lakes are cool
like,
lakes.
Those marks are all like somebody took a gigantic garden fork made of ice and just ripped the whole skin of the world.
As, you know, you get these biases coming from California, Finger Lakes, Schminger Lakes, you don't know. The canyons and the mountains and everything east of, let's say, the Rockies always seem kind of a joke. But I have to say the Finger Lakes, which I first heard about from some quip, a Jim Carrey quip, and it was very funny, the Finger Lakes, ha ha ha. But they're really beautiful. They're the most kind of California-esque thing that you sort of see, or topography or whatever that you see in this part of the country. And, you know, and it's wine country. I think it's the largest sort of or best wine country probably east of the Pacific States. They make actually really good wines there because they're not very large mountains, but they're sort of these kind of sloping, you know, mountains that go down to these lakes. And one side is always perfect and it'll have a certain amount of moisture and fog and the right kind of subclimates, I don't know what you call it, for the proper cooling. And so it's all vineyards. And they grow certain kinds of grapes, and it's more of a kind of like a Northern European white grape. This isn't a grape show. It's supposed to be a war show, but I'm just describing it anyway.
We'll get cool. Jerry Joutel back because he knows absolutely everything about every wine.
Yeah, by the way, and I think I told you where you are in Puglia has the Primitivo wines, which I have been told are the same thing as the Zinfandels from California. But you're not a wine, you never were much of a wine fan like me.
I mean, it doesn't agree with me in all kinds of ways. Mm-hmm. I did really enjoy at one time the weekly ritual of getting like two bottles of wine and putting a video of Army of Darkness in, and then just shouting every line along with Ash.
Yeah, that does sound fun. My wine thing, it began because of grapes. I was just convinced grapes, as a child, I just associate grapes with the only relief from heat in the Bay Area suburbs, and they just seemed like they could not have come from anything but some god or something, because they were just so perfect. And then it was like, oh my god, the juice turns into wine. And you know, and I remember trying, I stole or was given, I can't remember it, at a Passover when I was like six. I got drunk for my first time. I thought it was really cool.
You got drunk on like Manischewitz?
Yeah, Manischewitz, yeah.
Man, oh man, a Chevitz, what a wine. I remember those commercials.
I don't remember those. That's funny. I don't remember commercials for them, but it was like grape juice that right. had the added bonus of getting you drunk and then you vomit in the back of your parents' car and stuff. But right. Anyways, we have I don't know why we're so cheerful, because going through the last year has been a pretty depressing exercise. And
it was particularly hard for me today, because like we're in hotels. We had to switch hotels to get a better connection. And the hotel we left this morning has the custom of all Italian hotels at this time of year of doing the same collection of Christmas duets. And I realized the Christmas duet is the most suicidally depressing subgenre of music in the whole world. Like, it's two people who probably once thought they were going to go to Hollywood and become big stars, and now they're reduced to doing duets of Baby, It's Cold Outside. Mm-hmm. And I always wonder, like, oh man, they must be really depressed. Like, how did it happen for me this way? But you know, and then I realized the real effect of those songs is when you hear five of them in a row while you're eating breakfast is extreme depression and a sense of sleaze, you know, deep sleaze by people who are pretending to be romantic. And that's when I realized, yeah, that's why Fairy Tale of New York works as a duet, because it does a Christmas duet that absolutely upends that. Like, it was Christmas Eve, babe, in the drunk tank. an old man said to me, won't see another one. And then it goes off into a, you know, kind of quixotic, happy verse at the last bit of it. But it directly dumps you in what every one of those Christmas duets has been making you feel without coming to consciousness all at once. That, God, this is depressing.
Yeah, it's something from our parents' world, something very depressing from our parents' world. I mean, all those songs seem to come from our parents. I mean, mine and yours, probably not Young's. We're parents, I'm a parent, whatever. Like, we're the parents' age, or grandpa, getting grandpa age now. But like, those songs depress me for that reason. That whole generation of everything about the 40s pop culture just brings me down a bit. But I don't know. There's one duet that I do like. It's not one of those lush romantic duets like the ones you're talking about, but the David Bowie Bing Crosby one, the drummer boy, you know that one?
Okay, that is just weird.
It is.
I mean, that song is truly weird.
It is. And Bowie's in like, he's in the throes of one of his probably very weirdest phases. You know, he's like, if you've seen the video of it.
Twitching and stuff?
Yeah, twitching and... Somehow his eyes are even more off than normal. You know, he's got the different colored pupils. Like, his face is whiter. I don't know. He's either deep in the speedball period of his life or just after it. I don't know. At that period, he looked like an alien. I mean, it's pretty funny. Yeah. Right. So, Christmas is hell, and it's... For me, it's just the hell of gifts that I'm not getting on time for people, and the panic that causes.
Which is probably a very common one. and it's a big deal for kids.
It is a big deal for kids. Yeah, Christmas, Hanukkah, all that shit. So,
I thought we should try to find a slogan for the year, and the only one I could really come up with that seemed to fit is. The year they stop being nice, you know, or that non-Christmas song, This Is England.
Oh yeah, The Clash without Mick Jones, right?
Without Mick Jones, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, because that kind of gets the tone here. Like, there are a lot of illusions that have been wiped off the board. Illusions of benevolence and the notion that there are standards in the higher world that, okay, maybe on Fox News they get tricky and slimy, but they're, you know, dumb as they are, sometimes at least the New York Times and the big networks sort of try in their centrist way. They didn't try at all this year.
Yeah.
They stopped.
Yeah, they went dark, and as they say, mask off. And yeah. It would seem to be suicidal, and it is actually, and it's a kind of self-subversion in order to hold on to what they have. And there's a lot of it, and obviously the biggest, you know, entry into this trend is the genocide in Gaza by Israel, and the way that the U.S. and the Western states are throwing the whole sort of post-war liberal international order, you know, down the toilet,
yeah,
just to protect their baby. And it seems like a very, very short-sighted trade-off. But and that's what it is. It's a very short-sighted trade-off, I think. You know, who knows how this comes out? But
I think that's what's going on in a lot of ways. Like, the Democratic Party really stonewalled and tried to protect Biden, and now it comes out that everybody knew that he was senile, that he had no brain left.
Yeah,
and but
going
they
back
did
to
it.
2021. They
yeah.
Knew.
Yeah. And they lost. They lost big. And I get the feeling that in some way, if you're already in that elite, it pays off for you in the way that you're talking about. You don't have to win. You just have to maintain the institution and keep your jobs and keep it turning over.
The press covered for it too. It's kind of amazing how many stories the press, major blockbuster stories, the center left establishment press have screwed up. I mean, the New York Times was putting out scare stories, if I remember right, as late as May of this year, that that the far right was starting to substitute for Russia by this point, because the New York Times and the Washington Post, you know, psychic drove their audiences for 4 years about Russia controlling Trump, and then the whole Mueller report fell apart, about collusion. So they came out and said that the far right has been spreading what they called cheap deep fakes that try to show Biden as if he is in mental decline and has dementia. But it's so, again, it's the same thing. So if you click on it, if you believe your eyes, they were saying, then you are a sucker for far right, that is to say fascist Nazi propaganda. You are a Nazi. If you think that he is showing signs of mental decline, you're a Nazi.
That's a really interesting example, because I always thought that fable, when I was a kid, I was like a real Fable fan, but I was a very critical Fable fan in a primitive kid-like way. And I thought, The Emperor's New Clothes, yeah, I get the point, but nobody'd buy that. And it's, but this was the same thing. Yes, you cannot, who are you going to believe, me or your lying eyes?
Along those lines, there have been, as the year has closed out, there have been another few stories. We'll get to Israel and Gaza in a second, but just now, along these lines of the West ditching its kind of most fundamental, you know, norms and values and standards and institutions, even, like the UN court, the ICJ, and the other one, the International Criminal Court rulings. But here, just elections. So you had boom, 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 three in a row. You had a referendum in Moldova on joining the EU. And there were a lot of scare stories coming out about how Russia was manipulating, was going to try and manipulate it. The opposition, the main opposition party, which does have ties with Russia, but is run by this Israeli, actually, is run by an Israeli oligarch, Israeli-Moldovan oligarch. They restricted their ability to participate. And what happened was they lost the vote within Moldova. First, they counted up all the votes inside of Moldova on the referendum, yes or no, to join the EU or to put it into the constitution or whatever, to join the EU. And no came out ahead. And then all of the diaspora votes started coming in. And and that tipped it. And everybody knows this thing was fudge. I mean, put it this way, if it was the other way around, everybody would accuse Russia of tipping that vote. But one way we know that this was rigged, first of all, we don't know specifically about like how actual votes might have been changed. But what they did do was the Moldovan embassy, Moldova is led by a very pro-EU, pro-NATO president, Maia Sandu. They and her government made sure that in all the Western European countries where there are Moldovan, basically, you know, remittance pay workers, there are a lot of Moldovans.
Yeah.
I mean, a good quarter of the country is left.
Well,
the
doctor who saved my life. Right. In Kurdistan, when I had an undiagnosed case of pernicious anemia, was Moldovan.
Right.
So I have a fond memory of, well, not memory, fond association.
So in a place like Italy, where there are a lot of Moldovan migrants working there, they set up dozens of points where you could, places where you could vote. The government did. To make it as easy as pie, like literally like outside of every, you know, lousy barracks or wherever these Moldovan migrant workers live so that they could vote. And it was assumed when they live in Western Europe, they're going to vote yes to the EU. Mm-hmm. Whereas in Russia, and there are hundreds of thousands of Moldovan migrant workers in Russia itself, they only set up two voting booths. So no one could really vote there. So you already had a massive
two
vote.
Voting.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. Something crazy like that. And a lot of people who are not Russia stans, who are more just sort of, you know, they just watch this stuff, were really shocked by how brazenly that was stolen. Then you had the vote in Georgia where the wrong party won. Georgian Dream won 53% of the vote. And so the EU and the US have decided that actually, no, that vote was rigged. And they're backing, you know, the protests to overturn the vote and force a new vote. And they back the president, who is the president, which is a ceremonial post, but she's French born and she opposes the Georgian Dream government. We talked on the show with Sopa Chaparidze about all this. So where the wrong side won, we're saying that that was rigged.
Yeah.
Where the good side lost, we helped cover for, you know, basically a massive vote rigging. And then what just happened in Romania, which is an EU country and a frontline state, is the wildest thing of all. And this is just coming out now, how it went down. So basically what happened is they had first round of elections, Romania did last month. And this you know, classic quote-unquote populist, a far-right demagogue, fan of the Iron Guard, against, you know, against basically ramping things up with NATO, want the Ukrainian refugees out, that kind of far-right guy. His name is Kalin Georgescu. He wound up surprising, shocking everyone and winning the first round hands down and was looked like he was going to win the second round between, you know, the top two vote getters pretty easily, Kalin Georgescu. So then the Constitutional Court looked at what happened and Romanian intelligence said his whole TikTok campaign was a Russian operation. And Russia.
Yeah, there's a lot of hostility to TikTok because
yes,
the wrong people are using it, and they need to stop.
Well, the worst thing is the wrong people, but the wrong people own it, which is started up by Chinese entrepreneurs, and their algorithm for TikTok is an algorithm that Facebook and like have not been able to crack or replicate. It's a much better algorithm, and so young people love it. It just works better. For that, people who like that shit. But anyway, so they said that Russia, without providing any proof, Russia ran his campaign. And so then the Constitutional Court canceled the election victory and said they have to redo the election. So you just canceled it. And today, so that was shocking enough. Like, because attribution is so sketchy whenever you say somebody manipulated social media, set up accounts. I mean, we know this because we were the first ones in a lot of ways to go through this, you know, in 2016. Yeah. Attribution is whatever you want to say it is. It's whoever you hire.
That's the dropping of standards. Not dropping in the sense of decline, just fuck them. No more of that stuff.
Here's where it gets even cruder. It turns out that the TikTok campaign, and this has just been leaked and declassified, that TikTok campaign, which really did help work for this far-right candidate, was actually set up and funded by the ruling National Liberal Party because they thought that they could boost this marginal guy's numbers to help them win the presidential election.
My God, that, you know, dummies always think the same way, like Clinton convincing Trump to run for president.
Exactly. So it turns out, and this whole thing has been exposed. They hired some marketing firm called Kensington Communications. They paid them $210,000. And so they used some platform which coordinated. They gave scripts to all these Romanian influencers, and these scripts were read out. And Politico tried to spin it. Well, Politico is an intelligence dump. Like, so basically, if you have a problem and you need crisis management, you massage a story before it gets big and put it in Politico's to frame it in most people's minds. I think Politico is trying to say that this leak was somehow massaged by Russia, but nobody's really buying it. Like it's coming out that it's like this: the establishment liberal pro EU party tried to fix the election by setting up a far right guy, claiming he's backed by the Russians, and then when that backfired on them, then they used the same project that they funded to say actually he is he's a traitor and he was run by the Russians, even though they ran it. And Romanian intelligence backed that up without evidence, but they just said, yeah, we can't release all of our evidence for why. And they've all been caught doing it, and the Constitutional Court, of Romania, validated all that. They canceled the election. And I mean, I guess this is what I mean by like you try and subvert yourself in the medium and long term for what you think is a short term gain, but you're actually screwing yourself in the short term as well. And I got to say, it reminds me a bit, of course, of echoes of 2016 and the way that the Hillary campaign basically fed intelligence to the FBI. I mean, the whole thing is, we're going to get, I think this is what Trump is going to do, spend a lot of time on is digging into the whole Russiagate, reopening that up, because it is so raw and so alive, Russiagate, for the right, in a way that the centrists and the left are like, that's all history, that's behind us. Not for the people on the right at all. There's going to be hearings, there's probably going to be investigations. I wouldn't be surprised.
Well, I'm for that, actually. Yeah. That's a weird feeling. But, I mean, that was the first time they just suddenly turned on a dime and said, God, the intelligence agencies are heroes.
Yeah.
I mean, people who got into journalism because in my generation, they saw all the President's Men and they thought, oh, I want to be like Redford and Hoffman. And suddenly it's like, God, the intelligence agencies are our last line. And whatever they tell me, it's got to be true, especially if they tell me that we didn't really lose and we aren't really hated by ordinary people. We were just cheated.
And all those journalists who did that, who pushed Russiagate, they're all there. They won Pulitzers up the wazoo for it. And they saw themselves, I remember, I mean, if you remember, I had that meeting with Lowell Bergman, you know, who was Al Pacino played him in The Insider, and some other people just right after the 2016 election. He was talking about how all the, and he was, I think, well, he was at Berkeley Journalism School, but he was going to Columbia. And he was talking about all the money and all the efforts being put into Watergate 2, which they were all going to find the reasons to get Trump impeached and out. And they were all just, they were sure it was there. It was like an Easter egg hunt. It was just, it was a matter of finding it. And who gave them the Easter eggs? The intelligence agencies. That's why it's so bad. Yeah, ass backwards. But I wanted to say real quickly, and we'll move on, that the Romania story reminds me a bit of this sort of by-election in 2017 between, it was in Alabama for Senate, and the Republicans ran this genuine loon, Roy Moore, and, you know, really like on the far Christian nationalist right.
Oh, yeah, who also was hitting on some teenager in a local mall or something?
That's what he was accused of. I think he won a defamation suit about that, though, later, much more quietly. But so I'm not sure. I don't know. But that was part of it. But anyway, so it was him against Doug Jones, who was like this kind of good center-right Democrat. And he won, and they held that seat for a couple of years and then lost it again. He won a very close race, the Democrat did, by like 20,000 votes. And it turned out, because one of the big stories in that race was Russia backed Roy Moore, and there were Russian bots all the newspapers were pointing to that were supporting Roy Moore and smear and going after the other guy. And it turned out that the whole Russian bots campaign was run by this group set up by the Democrats called New Knowledge. And they are an anti-disinformation, you know, elections validation group that also worked for the United States Senate on tracking Russian disinformation. And they were caught. It came out in 2018 that they ran an experiment where they actually set up the Russian bots. They ran the Russian bots for Roy Moore. And then they sent notifications to friendly journalists like in Mother Jones and some other places. And some of these journalists knew this for a long time, but they wanted to go along with this. Yeah. Not the Mother Jones guys, but a guy from the New York Times actually knew about it and admitted later he kept it secret.
Well, yeah, I mean, this continues. Like, I think it was Chris Salitza. I don't watch these people, but he's apparently a big name in insider journalism. He said, "Yeah, we all knew Biden. Biden's brain had sort of dribbled out of his ears, and you know, we thought it was for the good of the country, so we kept it quiet."
Yeah, and instead, it's again one of these short-term. Yeah. Let's lie to the people to protect this thing called democracy. And actually, you've just screwed it harder over and over. And no one learns a thing because no one is ever held accountable. And the system as it is set up so that that the only way they'll be held accountable is if they hold themselves accountable, because there is no way to hold them accountable except to vote for the anti-system candidate and to vote with your eyeballs for an anti-systemic media. That's all you can do.
The whole logic of Russia as the source of all evil is strikingly like Satan as the root of all evil, that's so regularly mocked by these people as the arcane superstition of, you know, flyover people. But it's no more primitive than attributing any result that you don't like to a really pretty incompetent mid-range power like Russia.
Yeah.
Russia, as far as I know, doesn't have the finesse of the American political manipulation overseas machine.
Yeah, or the power, or the money, basically. I mean, the West just has so much more money, has so much more influence. I mean, just what they're doing in Georgia, it's just, it's incredible.
Oh, by the way, did you see the story from Abkhazia today?
Which one is that?
One of the Abkhazian legislators opened fire.
Oh, yeah.
killed one other legislator, wounded another. I don't quite know what it's about, but I'm sure he was provoked.
Yeah, I don't know the deep details of it. I do know that there was a protest. Basically, there was a law that was being pushed through that was going to allow foreigners, basically Russian capital, to buy land and assets in Abkhazia. And, you know, if you remember, even I think from Limonov, even like Sukhumi was, and the mandarins from there were just always
Absolutely.
Famous, you know, at the beaches of Sukhumi.
Yeah.
And it's prime real estate, and it's adjacent to where Sochi area is.
I mean,
is.
We both remember that line from Slavka, the gypsy, says to Eddie Baby in Podrosok Savienko. It's like, lemons, you understand, Eddie Baby? Lemons grow there.
Yes.
They're in the middle of a winter desolation in Saltovka.
Yeah, in Kharkiv. So this law would have allowed Russians, who are obviously Russian capital, is far more powerful than this small breakaway statelet of Abkhazia, which has, I don't know, 300,000 people maybe. They'd be able to buy up everything. And that caused riots, and they forced the Abkhazian parliament to basically, the government to resign. And I think there's still fallout from that fight. And I think the Russians are kind of playing hardball with them. And there's another theory that actually what the Russians might be doing, I mean, I've seen this from some Georgians as well, is not just so that Russians can buy up all these assets, but the law would allow Georgians also to come in and start buying up pieces of Abkhazia, and it would be kind of a soft way of Russia-Georgian relations to warm up, but at the expense of the Abkhazian, like the current rulers of right. Abkhazia right now. So that's why we're talking gunfire. I mean, we're talking property and sovereignty. So yeah, gunfire
right,
makes
right.
sense. And it's a very, like Abkhazia, you know, as I said, it's only a few hundred thousand people. And
in that kind of size community, it's like, well,
yeah.
Look, I can make some demographic changes at the meeting tonight.
Yes.
Just on my own.
Yeah. And everybody, I'm sure, knows everybody. And there's a whole lot of layers of feuds there.
Yeah.
So one thing I want to bring up really quickly, I feel like I have to from the last episode, and then we'll move on. Ford Ram, the Ford Ram
yes.
pickup truck. Yeah, I'm going to call it Ford Ram for the rest of my goddamn life if I have to. No,
yeah.
I got the Ford Ram wrong. Apparently, it's a Mercedes Ram. No, apparently it's another brand car, and I'm just not going to get that one right. I called it a Ford Ram, and boy, did pickup truck pedants, don't mess with them. And I have my own pedant on a lot of things, so I understand that. But pickup truck pedants, do not mess with them.
Yeah, well, especially black pickup trucks that have things that look like rivets instead of, you know, ordinary hubcaps.
Yeah.
Don't mess with them.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I know what you mean. Yes. Right. So let's talk about, the big war, of course, the big story. Maybe we start with it.
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking the way we can introduce this, I think, is like, yeah, it's all fun and games when Americans and other wealthy northern countries agree to lie to themselves. But it's quite another thing when they take their lies on the road and basically post a cone of lies over some of the places that are already the most wretched in the world. And we saw an example of that in the last couple of years in Gaza and the West Bank and Lebanon. This was a live stream genocide. Mm-hmm. An incredible record number of journalists and children killed. That's supposedly one of the, in fact, those are two of the big standards that we were told. Mm-hmm. You don't kill journalists, you don't kill children. Well, yes, you do, if it turns out you're a close ally of NATO.
200 journalists. There's just been nothing like this. Nothing close.
No. Yeah, I think that's the most essential thing we have to say, that this is a different league. Yeah. And people who talk about norms all the time and are appalled at Trump for his rudeness didn't really object to these norms, because those the norms they care about are diction, politeness, and the horrible, horrible deaths of poor people in areas that are already stigmatized don't strike them as issues of politeness. And so they don't get a lot of attention. There's a belief that I guess I've always had, that one death is one death, and it should count roughly equally. One horrible maiming is one horrible maiming, and it should count equally, no matter whether it's some kid in Gaza or somebody who's been on the Sunday interview shows. But it's really not true. I mean, if you consider the endless publicity given to that made man in the DC mafia who was dismembered in the Saudi embassy, and we never heard the end of it. But that was a made man. And the people who died in Gaza, in Palestine, were not. And
I mean, to be crude, the 1,200 Israelis, 1,200 Israelis who died on October 7th count far more than the, I don't know, estimated, 200,000 plus who have died in Gaza.
Yeah, you could probably do a graph of that. It's like, I don't know, like 18 to 1 or something like that. Yeah. I'll just do some quick stats here. Lancet, the British medical magazine, said after a survey, applying a conservative estimate of the indirect deaths to the 37,000 deaths reported in Gaza, it is not implausible to estimate that up to 186,000 or even more deaths could be attributable to the current conflict in Gaza.
And that was 186, months ago, 000. Right? That was many months ago, yeah.
Right, that was July 10th.
Yep.
And nothing has stopped since then.
No.
They've stopped paying attention to it, but it hasn't stopped.
Yes.
As of now, I would think, I'm not sure of the date on this stat, but the estimate is that 45,000 people have been killed in Gaza, including 18,000 children, 108,000 have been injured, 11,000 are missing. The toll from the West Bank is equally awful. Doctors have been targeted. Reporters have been targeted. And this, to me, I don't know about you, Mark, but to me, this is one of the most surprising aspects of the masks off attitude of the media. I thought they at least had some guild loyalty to their own profession. And yet hundreds of journalists have been killed and it doesn't seem to bother them.
Those journalists, I mean, there's a tribal aspect, which is they're on the other side, and also the genocide makes my team look bad. I mean, mainstream reporters, you know, they those values count until their side looks bad. And we saw where their loyalties lie. It's even more with the empire than even with Joe Biden, right? Because we saw that with the Afghanistan withdrawal, their freak out at Biden in August 2021.
Yeah.
And that was the first time the press turned on Biden and his numbers, it was relentless. I mean, I was here.
It was very bipartisan too. Like, yeah. So-called liberals were appalled that America lost face there.
Yeah. And it was really relentless for 2 weeks. And that was the first time that Biden's poll numbers really sank and never recovered after that. Mm. And
the best decision he ever made in his rotten presidency, and that was the one that hurt him.
Yeah, that's the one the press turned on him. So, I mean, the class of people who run, you know, the corporate media, where these people come from, they tend to be from well-connected media families or very wealthy families. They tend to have gone to a few schools. And then the people who come into that world from outside of that sort of nepotistic culture need to conform to that culture very badly. Mm. And they all love the empire means everything to them, and the prestige of the empire means everything. And those 200 journalists, I think there were, I wonder if an actual American citizen is among them or a dual citizen. I mean, we know that the Al Jazeera reporter who was targeted and shot and killed by Israelis in the West Bank, that was a couple years ago. Biden and Blinken ran cover for Israel over that, even though that was an American citizen. The New York Times eventually, I think, did do an investigation long after sort of covering for Israel. Israel says, you know, that kind of bullshit.
Right.
Then they did do an investigation, or is the Washington Post, and it became pretty clear that, yeah, Israel knew she was a journalist, specifically targeted her and assassinated her. And there were no repercussions whatsoever. But what's going on in Gaza, on top of the fact that the media class supports Israel, just like the whole Acela corridor and the whole foreign policy class supports the empire, but also these journalists are Palestinian, and Israel, you know, this should be the lead of any story that any Western media does about the Gaza war, any one of them, should be that foreign journalists are barred by Israel from entering Gaza. They have barred them for most, if not all, of the period of the war. They can't get in. So you can only rely on locals for their reporting. And there have been brilliant local reporters. And they have been targeted. They have been targeted and assassinated specifically because they're getting these gruesome stories out. And, you know, I think that Western reporters, American reporters, are very embarrassed by what's going on. They want it to go away. They would love for this to get off the front pages just as much as the whole DC, you know, foreign policy class and the whole frickin' ruling class. It is, I have to say, you know, it's kind of the power of American Western values that we can be shocked by this because we do still believe it, and they do. They demand that we follow these norms and rules all the time, and demand that official enemy states or states that are neutralist follow these norms and rules. And they claim to uphold them until they don't want to. And it's like, but
I mean, that's why I always think Hunter Thompson doesn't get enough credit. Like, he could often crystallize a key fact about life under the empire in a single phrase, like, "Hey, Rube."
Yes.
That should be the whole media slogan. "Hey, Rube."
Yeah. And a lot of them, you know, look, there's rarely been so much consensus from, you know, the major, really liberal, kind of secular liberal global institutions, human rights institutions, that what Israel is doing is a genocide. It's a very big deal. It's very hard to get that. These organizations guard these kinds of verdicts very closely because they don't want, they want their own power and their power of the words to matter. And so they don't just throw it around easily. I'm talking about Amnesty, Human Rights Watch, Medecins Sans Frontières, and of course the much bigger ones, the International Court of Justice and the International Criminal Court. And they've all ruled that. And yet I saw the other day on my feed, Josh Marshall, who is basically just a, you know, a Democratic Party insider and kind of the center left wing. He runs Talking Points Memo, which at one time wasn't bad in the Bush years, and then just became sort of an arm of the Democratic Party. And he was having one of his usual troll fights with somebody. He was a big Russia gator, by the way, huge Russia gator. And you know, somebody brought up the genocide in their little spat, and he said, first of all, there is no genocide. You know, let's just get that out of the way. And that is the attitude, I think, of these people. Like, there is no genocide. Freaking Amnesty came out with it, and everybody in that world knows how meaningful it is if Amnesty goes all the way and says X is a genocide. And, you know, this is a buried article in the Western, in Washington Post, New York Times, the major media. It's just buried. BBC buried it. There was a story that came out on Drop Site News through Owen Jones. He talked to a bunch of BBC people who all asked to remain anonymous for fear for professional retribution. So they all remained anonymous, and there's like a quiet revolt in there, but they can't do anything about it.
Yeah, I've read something about 900 BBC journalists signing an objection to the tilt.
The tilt, yeah. And then there was specifically even about this. I mean, they waited almost a day after the embargo. So Amnesty will send out like a press release, and it's embargo. So you put on an embargo time so that everybody can kind of report it at the same time. It's just standard PR, or, you know, for some news item or whatever. And BBC waited for almost a day after the embargo is lifted, when you can then report the story, to put it up. They buried it on their front page of the online site, which is the most widely read online news site in English language. They put it far down. Then it was off within a day. It wasn't even on the homepage or anywhere after the first day. And it wasn't even in sort of like the tabulated news items for the Israel-Gaza war until about a week later. Then suddenly it appeared there. That's actual burying the story.
Yeah.
Grim.
It's shocking. And I have to say, my generation, and I had no choice about joining my generation. As soon as I was born, I was in it. I mean, it was like enrolled at birth. I never liked those hippies anyway. But they have been truly awful about Gaza. They've got something, and I've said this before, but I'll say it more directly now. They have something about Arabs. Like, Arab suffering doesn't count. Arab death doesn't count. And their hearts have been hardened in a pretty scary way. I don't know how it happened. I might have been out of the country at the time, or, you know, maybe they had Tommy Lee Jones and Will Smith just, you know, flash their little zapper at them. But I see this in the comments in the New York Times, because those are mostly probably older so-called liberals. You can't make them care about Arab lives. I don't get it.
Yeah, it's like that boomer State Department guy, Stuart Seldowitz, you know, who's famously go up to this
harassing a food cart worker.
Yeah, and telling him about, you know, harassing him every day. I hear 4,500 Palestinian children have been killed in Gaza. It's not enough. Trying to provoke a reaction so that then you film, he would on his side then go to the police and say, I've been a victim of anti-Semitism. And the guy never took the bait. He said, Seldowitz say to him, you know, I know about this, that you want to get visited by the Mukhabarat in Egypt? You from Egypt? You know, they'll pull each of your fingernails. Yeah. And I mean, just a gruesome asshole. And this guy was a liberal.
He got a slap on the wrist too.
He did. I mean, he did. Was, better he's than probably nothing.
Been, yeah, he's probably been protected all his life. He's part of that whole brain trust that's been running America's massively successful Middle Eastern policy. But I think the main point for me with this is don't ever believe them again.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, some Palestinians have been saying this on Twitter, like, I'll never believe you again. I'll never believe any of your bullshit about how you have standards.
That will be some of the fallout from this. And we don't know how this is going to really manifest itself, except that obviously the American credibility, Western credibility, and the institutions that have kind of been a pillar of this whole post-war liberal international order. I mean, they are really weakened. And it's so fitting that actually it wasn't Trump that weakened them. It was the people who came in to fix everything, that all the threats that Trump supposedly posed to this. That's Biden's and Blinken's, their entire pitch is that we are the adults back in the room. We are the ones that are going to restore this whole post-war liberal international order that was under threat from this Russian-backed outlier, you know, who should have never been there. And they went in and just trashed it. And I think that has also, it's really blown away a lot of people who were all very used to trashing, you know, and American hypocrisy, Western hypocrisy. We're all used to it. And yet it still shocked us. And, I admit it.
I thought there was more to it than that. I thought went a little deeper.
I mean, as we talked about with Cyrus, this was also a calculation of Hamas and the axis of resistance up to October 7th, that the West, America in particular, would limit Israel's rampage, as America has always in the past. They allow Israel to do a certain level of murderous rampage and then rein them in. And that they thought that ultimately for America, upholding these pillars of its own, of its whole pact, like the soft side of the Pax Americana, that was more important than protecting Israel, a right to commit genocide. And it really is nuts. Still kind of hard to make sense of.
A little anecdote. After, you know, failing as an academic, I tried to get into the Foreign Service in a desperate time. And they chose not to pursue my candidacy, as they told me. But I passed their exams, both written and in person in Washington, D.C. But what I remember is one of the big parts of the in-person exam was how well do you develop scenarios for messing with imaginary countries?
Really? Wow.
I swear.
Wow.
And you're divided into groups of like five, and you have some situation which involves really cheesy imagined countries in relation with each other. And you're supposed to come up with a plan which will work it all out, whatever problems they had. And it really reminded me of the level of Federation interference in those first wave Star Trek commercials, you know, with Captain Kirk and Mr. Spock. It's like, How can you do a 50-minute scenario where you have a Cold War thing versus the Klingons and you make peace on the planet of Orudio or whatever it is? And there were people desperately trying to shine. And in fact, what I remember is I'm wearing my $3 suit from Value Village in Las Vegas, and it's kind of straining at the waist. And I'm leaning into this discussion in literal and other senses. And I swear, I felt for a moment like that actor in Galaxy Quest who halfway through the program goes, "How can I be doing this? I'm classically trained." I mean, I'm trying to impress these people with my ability to mess with a couple of imaginary countries out of a cheap novel. And it does develop, I would think, a pitiful sort of Star Trek God complex.
On top of the ongoing Israeli slaughter in Gaza. And it's amazing to me a couple of things. One is that Hamas and Islamic Jihad, Palestinian Islamic Jihad, they're still fighting.
Yeah.
If you follow Electronic Intifada, and they're amazing. I'll say this again, Electronic Intifada. We had Ali Avnima on the show this year, one of our great interviews this year. And they put out regular shows every week, and I try to listen. And I got to say, I don't know how they have not developed. I wonder if they have PTSD just from reporting. They go deep every week. They leave no stone unturned, no victim forgotten.
Mm-hmm.
But they also have a segment with John Elmer, which recounts the latest acts of resistance, of armed resistance. And they are still fighting. It's unbelievable. And they're still recruiting.
I know.
Yeah.
I got to say, I never thought Hamas was this formidable.
Yeah.
And I did think that Hezbollah was more formidable. And instead, it seems like it's been Hezbollah that has backed off or just declared, made peace in a humiliating way. And Hamas is still in there fighting, and it's extraordinary.
Yeah, it is extraordinary. And but, you know, on the grim, horrible side of it, I mean, Israel is killing dozens and dozens of people. I mean, every day if you're on social media and you follow Palestine accounts, you see dead children, and every freaking day, new weapons being tried. I mean, I've been reading these reports about people reporting, you know, there was the report about the Israeli drone that goes out in front of doorways where they know that people are hiding out. And then it gives off sounds of either mothers crying or babies or children crying for help. And then people run out and then another drone with guns shoots them. It's like right out of...
That is straight out of a PKD...
Nazi.
Speed withdrawal novel.
And there are other reports. I mean, you know, again, we also had a great interview with Anthony Lowenstein. That was at the end of 2023, of Palestine as a laboratory for the world. And so they are testing new weapons. And one I've heard about is this, again, a PKD type of weapon. It's a drone that it fires off these like tiny little sharp shards that just slice people up. This isn't the the switchblade. It's not like that. It's more like a maiming drone. Really just gruesome stuff. And the Israelis have been, you know, there was this plan called the General's Plan that was leaked, which was to draw a line in the northern part of Gaza and turn it into a full free fire zone in order to completely ethnically cleanse it. Very much along the lines of how the Wehrmacht turned parts of Belorussia into a free fire zone in World War II, which we talked about in our Operation Bagration series with Anibale. And they're doing it. It was out there. It was put out there. They're doing it. We're all watching it happen, and it's happening, and people are being killed if they haven't been able to get out or haven't gotten out, and they have been driven out. And settlers are already trying to set up settlements there. And it's so gruesome. I mean, there was early on in the conflict, and this has all been entered into the record for why the ICJ and ICC have ruled this genocide and crimes against humanity. Ministers were saying that we need to massively reduce the population there to a more manageable level, as they called it. And they're doing that in front of us.
Yeah, that sort of talk was one of the things that was supposed to be forbidden.
Yes.
You weren't going to talk that way anymore, not after the Nuremberg trials. And that was one of those red lines that has just been obliterated. The red lines, you know, turned out they weren't painted on the pavement at all. They were just projected onto it by, you know, some film strip thing that could be turned off when it was convenient.
And then we have to talk about the big story, which is how the year has ended off, which is essentially the defeat, at least for now, if not for a while, of the Axis of Resistance and that whole structure.
For example, the Syrian war seemed to have ended in at least stalemate, and a stalemate that sort of favored the Syrian government. But then very suddenly, just at the end of the year, in an operation that must have had a lot of planning from Turkey and various other Western...
And the U.S.,
agencies. Then Jolani, whose militias had not had much power before, stormed through the country.
Walked through it, practically.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because there was little to no resistance. And, you know, there was, again, there was, speaking of plans announced or leaked and then carried out, I think it was around September or so, there were stories in Politico, which is, again, the sort of the D.C. government dump, but also elsewhere, of top American officials, I assume Amos Hochstein, who's the envoy, and Brent McGurk, who's been tinkering with the Middle East since the Bush years, saying this is a great opportunity. Now we have a great opportunity to remake the Middle East. And people were kind of horrified by that, but they're doing it. Yeah. And looking at what has happened and constructing it somewhat backwards, I don't want to make it seem like these are super brilliant people, but, you know, this seems to be the plan. I mean, Israel's
enemies...
Well,
it took them a while, you know.
It did.
It took them a long time.
But Israel's enemies are America's, or the American Empire's enemies. Iran as sort of the mothership, and then Hezbollah, and Syria, and...
Well, Syria especially, I think, was... in some way more America's enemy than Israel's. I don't exactly know why, but it was always a priority in D.C. Like, we're going to take them down.
Yeah.
We're going to take Assad down.
Right. That goes back to what the plans were of the Bush administration after 9/11 is that's it. We're going to knock down all these regimes. And they have. I think Wesley Clark in some speech famously had named them. It was, you know, Iraq, Syria. Syria, it was always supposed to be next.
Yeah.
Libya, which is gone. Again, we talked about this with Cyrus as well. Sudan, which is gone. Hezbollah, which is in a state, but it has to go. And then Iran. Iran is the hardest one. And if you look at that, if you look at those states, I mean, certainly by the time Biden came to power, Iran, Hezbollah, Syria, and the Houthis. Syria is actually the weak link in the axis of resistance. They weren't, as it's been described, they weren't like a kind of an ideologically deep member of the axis of resistance. It was in Assad's kind of more pragmatic interest to allow Iran to funnel arms to Hezbollah. And obviously Hezbollah is what, and we know now, really, Hezbollah is what propped up the Assad government. Hezbollah was the ground troops that propped up the Assad government. So how do you take down, if you can take out Syria, then Iran and Hezbollah are cut off from each other. How do you take out Syria if Syria is backed up by Russian air and Hezbollah ground troops and Iranian? Well, you degrade Hezbollah such that Hezbollah can't afford to keep their troops on two different fronts anymore. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's why, I mean, Israel and the U.S. had several reasons to go after Hezbollah in a big way. And yeah, it was really just a question of whether they were going to be able to pull it off. And they did.
And they did. I mean, yeah, as you say, last year, things looked relatively good for the so-called axis of resistance. And it came crashing down this time. I don't know. It has been at least a tactical defeat on a huge scale. I mean, I don't know that it's necessarily a good strategy that the U.S. and its proxies and allies are using. It's a very expensive strategy, literally and figuratively. It gunks the whole thing up, and it annoys the home front. I mean, part of the home front's revolt against Biden was they kept trying to tell his administration, stop screwing around with the rest of the world with our tax money. And Biden and company just couldn't hear that. It was unthinkable. Like, no, that's what we do.
Yeah.
That's what legitimizes us.
Yeah.
And I don't know that it's good for them to keep doing that. I don't know that it's good for the German Greens to keep doing their version of it. Because, you know, you do occasionally have to answer to voters. Biden is already gone. And a lot of other people are going to follow him, I think. But they have crushed pretty effectively that axis of resistance.
Yeah. I'm going to make a couple of points about that, and we'll talk more about it as well. But one thing that should be said, Hezbollah being weakened meant that Syria no longer had ground troops to prop up its extremely hollowed out government and support and militias and military and so on. So it just fell like a house of cards. That said, Hezbollah is not done. And I guess, you know, we didn't make that clear enough perhaps last time. It's not done as a force at all, actually. It is done as it is definitely defeated. And, you know, it signed a humiliating peace deal. It is humiliating because it delinked from Palestine, from Gaza, which is a very foundational defeat for Hezbollah. That said, the Israelis did not have a cakewalk through southern Lebanon. They didn't go very far. They inflicted a lot of damage, as far as we know, But it was also so damaging for them that they needed to call it off and take the win as it was, rather than the sort of total victory that they were hoping for, which is to completely crush Hezbollah. And as soon as that peace deal was signed, from everything I'm hearing, from what Cyrus reported, you know, from Lebanon, Hezbollah's supporters are completely 100% behind Hezbollah still.
Yeah.
They may have more problems maybe with some of the other sects or ethnic groups in the country. I'm not sure, but they're definitely very, like, they haven't lost the support of their community, and the Shia are the largest community in Lebanon, if not possibly the majority.
You're right, and that's an important point. But that, in a weird way, illuminates, if you can, you know, take the Soren's eye view, that illuminates the Israeli plans for Gaza. Like, how do you deal with an effective guerrilla force? You drain the sea, as many, many counterinsurgency theorists have advocated. And what that means is massacre, depopulation.
Yeah.
And yeah, if you may try to do that in Gaza, because it's almost like depopulating a jail.
Yeah.
It's a tightly imprisoned population. Southern Lebanon is not exactly like that.
Yeah.
Much bigger population, much freer to move about. So, yeah, if you don't exterminate Hezbollah, you're going to have problems with them down the line.
Yeah. And we should talk about the Houthis, Nasrallah, in this, because they haven't, they amaze me. I have a grim feeling about this, but they're kind of amazing. Like
they've lasted a long time.
You know that they, so just this morning, an American F-18H jet was supposedly brought down by friendly fire, which is possible, but I've seen a lot of people calling that really into question. It might have been air defense. It might have been something that Russia has transferred to them as part of retaliation for ATACMS hitting deep inside Russian territory, right? Because they've said openly, we're gonna get you back for that by creating problems elsewhere. We don't know.
In fact, there's something shrill and suspect in the way the U.S. Navy and their tame media insist that this was U.S. friendly fire incident, because the whole point of something called IFF, identification friend or foe, is that that shouldn't happen.
It can't happen almost. It
can't happen, no.
Yeah.
So it's a little odd. There's something suspect about the story.
All the electronics on, I was reading some former military guy talking about this. I mean, all of the electronic systems built into it are all about making sure it can't be misidentified as a drone or something. It's just, it's preposterous. Of course, anything is possible. Screw-ups happen, including technological ones, but it does not seem hugely likely. So I think, keep our eye on it.
And the Houthis also dropped a missile into an Israeli settlement. And it really, the punchlines kind of write themselves. Like, there was an IDF headquarters under the ground in that settlement. And, how do we know that there wasn't? They really do seem at the moment like the scrappy outsider, most especially because even though they are Shia and that's very important to them, they're very devout people, they came to Gaza's relief or tried to.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of Sunni Arab countries, to the great anger of their populations, did not.
Yeah.
So they not only did that, but they survived. They're hard to destroy because they don't have much in the first place. I mean, Rooster Cogburn says, we didn't have nothing but horses and revolvers. And the Houthi are kind of like that. Like, we didn't have much except some, missile tubes and the will to strike back beyond our power. And they're doing it. They're the very, very expensive tax on traffic through the Red Sea.
Yeah.
I mean, when the Navy launches an air defense missile, people don't realize how much that costs.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. Like, one would have thought, and I would assume that Israeli and American sort of thought, when Hezbollah was basically housebroken and forced to sign this humiliating ceasefire delinking from Gaza, that the Houthis would be like, because the Houthis received a lot of, help from Hezbollah during their war with the U.S.-backed, Saudi UAE war, that they would have thought, maybe we should, this could get bad for us. Because if these guys, Hezbollah, who really were the strongest Arab military poised against Israel, if they could be brought to heel, we need to be a little more careful. And they haven't. They have not changed. It's like what's so amazing is just before they fired that missile on Tel Aviv, was that yesterday? A couple of days before that, Israel with US and UK help did this massive bombing on Sana'a, Hodeidah, and other areas in Houthi-held northwestern Yemen, right. And really hit them hard. It was a much larger attack than what we've normally seen. And the Houthis just came, you know, it was thought that, like, this is another message. And so you better, you can, you know, it's maybe one thing to fire on some Panamanian registered ship. We won't maybe hit you quite as hard, but don't hit Israel. And what do? They just fire a rocket at Israel. Like, that is only meant as a provocation because it didn't disrupt Israel. It didn't, like, make Israel unable to hit, you know, Yemen again. But what it was a message also. Like,
yeah.
We're still going to do this, and we are not broken at all. Yeah. Come and get us. You know, it's kind of stunning in that way.
It is kind of charming. It's like, yeah. You know, the oaky resistance of the Arab world. I mean, when far more wealthy and educated and sophisticated countries are falling into line out of the cowardice of their elites, the Houthis just go on. And they've been locked in their own war inside Yemen, but they found time to devote a little attention to other areas.
Yeah, but I have to say, Israel and the U.S. might find a way to, I don't think they can be defeated the way that Hezbollah wasn't defeated. They were tactically, and for the purposes of this war, defeated. They might find a way to knock the Houthis out of this fight. I don't know.
Yeah.
It's true. I mean,
there've been a lot of attempts. I mean, the Saudis brought in their expensive aircraft, and those didn't do much good. They brought in mercenaries, and, you know, the mercenaries kind of decided it was a bad job. It's just such a rough place.
Yeah, but I wouldn't have thought Hezbollah could be knocked out.
That's true.
And, you know, yeah. I thought they would have been the last one to have been
absolutely
knocked out, and that was really the linchpin. So I don't know. I just, like, Israel can damage the Houthi military. We know that. Like, they can do a lot of damage with the U.S. intelligence help and all our arms. It hasn't worked so far. I'm not saying it's going to happen, but we can't discount that possibility. They can do a lot of damage. The Houthis, you know, the funny thing about the Houthis is in 2015, when the Saudi war on them started, they were literally, like, you know, as Walter Sobchak would say, I mean, the man in the black pajamas. I mean, they were with guns and pajamas and kicking their rich asses.
Yeah.
And now there are this very formidable, they're as close to a state military as a non-state actor can be, with hypersonic missiles or some version of hypersonic missiles and a capability of projecting force well beyond their little area. And so they've gotten stronger and stronger with each attempt to bring them to heel. And will that continue? I don't know. It's something we need to watch. But getting back again to the cracking of the axis of resistance, I mean, that is the big, grim, depressing story of the end of this year, or one of the big main ones anyway. It's the bad guys win. You know, this is also not supposed to happen, but by throwing away all those norms about genocide and everything, the genocidaires won, are winning. And damn.
And I'm sure very few of them even think of themselves in that way. But that's what they are. And to give them credit, if you can call it credit, then they won.
And one effect of this, we talked about this again in the last episode, and I have a feeling we might be seeing a lot more of this, is a kind of realignment among Arabs or supporters of Palestine, or which we've seen as soon as the axis of resistance was cracked. You've seen some very big name people in the Palestine world coming out and saying they never did anything for us anyway.
Yep.
And in fact, they screwed us and they never meant to help us. And Iran was just in it for their own money or whatever. Like, it's ugly. Part of this, though, of this realignment, I think we have to acknowledge as well is, look, Hamas is a Muslim Brotherhood affiliate, or, you know, grows out of the Muslim Brotherhood. We talked about this in our episodes on the history of Hamas. Muslim Brotherhood is Sunni Muslim Brotherhood. Its two main sort of state backers would be Turkey and Qatar. And now Turkey and Qatar have basically, their proxy has just taken control of Syria, HTS. I know it's Salafist, but this was Turkey's baby, you know?
Yep.
And so it's not exactly aligned with Muslim Brotherhood, but it is backed by to the hilt. I mean, put it this way, Saudis and the UAE, who are very anti-Muslim Brotherhood, like fanatically, normalized relations with Assad. And in fact, I think one of the reasons Assad didn't accept Erdogan's overtures when Erdogan was trying to come to a peace term and the Russians were trying to push Assad to come to some understanding with Erdogan. But the Saudis and the UAE despise more than anything Muslim Brotherhood. And they said, I think they encouraged him very much not to, and to play real hardball with them. And as soon as Jolani and HTS took Damascus, Qatar, which had never reopened its embassy and never normalized relations with Assad in Syria, immediately opened its embassy.
Yeah. And yeah, you raise another interesting point, which is Turkey is invisible for most Western coverage. It gets a mention in stories about what happened in Syria, but it never gets, let's say, agency. Mm-hmm. As they say in grad school, Turkey is controlling a lot of what happens in the region. And because it's got this history of being aligned with NATO, it doesn't get noticed as much as it should.
We've been talking about this for years on the show, and particularly because of your time spent with Kurds in Kurdistan and your sympathy for the Kurdish cause, you know, Turkey's front and center, if you think about the Kurdish cause as well. And focusing on Turkey, I think, has illuminated a lot for us. And, you know, we saw...
Still waiting, as it were, for the other bomb to drop when it comes to the Kurds.
Yeah, exactly.
That's something bad will happen soon.
Oh, yeah. In fact, Baerbock, the foreign minister for the Greens, who's always been a big public supporter of the Kurdish cause, she came out and said, you need to hand in your weapons. Basically, we're not going to support you anymore.
Yeah.
The Greens. Yeah.
That's a good policy. Sure. Okay. Yeah.
Yep. They're, and that's going to be the Western policy now.
Hey, it worked for the Armenians.
I know.
They don't have any troubles anymore. You know, they're not there anymore.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I think, this would be a good place to stop part one of our year and miserable year in review. Next episode, we'll talk about all the other wars and misery going on in the world.
The Horn of Africa in particular.
Horn of Africa. Yeah. And of course, we'll do an update on, we'll look at the year in Ukraine and few other fronts as well. So. All right. Thanks again, everyone. Okay, thanks, John.
Thanks, Brendan. Everybody.
All right. Talk to you soon. Bye.
Bye.